You are listening to Conversations in the Gospel of John, Episode 6. This episode was recorded in the spring of 2023 at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas, and I currently teach at Friends University. I hold a PhD in biblical studies from the University of Nottingham, and I was a pastor for about 16 years.
I've been involved with teaching and preaching in Baptist congregations for the past 30 years. I currently teach at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas, and hold a PhD in biblical studies from Baylor University. We're so thankful that you're choosing to listen to our conversation. Today, our guest is Tom Thatcher. Tom is a longtime writer in the Gospel of John. So how would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Hey, great to be with you guys, first of all. I would first like to introduce myself as a friend and colleague to both of you. And I'm very thankful for the chance to talk to you today and to talk to your listeners today. I went to seminary and first got introduced really to the serious study of the Gospel of John. Like most of us all did, worked in small church all through seminary and for some years beyond, and pursued a PhD in biblical studies with a New Testament emphasis way back in the day at the old Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, long time ago. Feels like a long time ago. I guess I feel older than I am, maybe. And was doing ministry the whole time I was there. And then after that, was called back to the school where I did my MDiv here in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I am now. I taught there for 28 years. Was the dean of the seminary for a while, was the provost of the school for a while, unfortunately. And then that school merged with another school, so I kind of retired from academia for the last couple of years. Guys and them lately have been actually working more as a consultant to not-for-profit ministries and to churches, some denominational bodies, and still some seminaries as well. My research now is kind of associated more explicitly probably than in the past with my work in the church, but I've always had a real strong foothold in the church, man, and love being involved in that.
So for such an old guy with such a long resume, who or what got you interested in the Gospel of John to start with?
Honestly, what got me interested in it was the least path of least resistance at a point in my career. So way back in seminary days, this was back in the 90s, I read Alan Culpepper's Anatomy of the Fourth Gospel when that was still a really hot take. Honestly, before that, I wasn't especially interested in the Gospel of John. I mean, obviously, I'd read it and preached or taught about it sometimes. I didn't care about that much. But that book really opened my eyes to like the depth of the presentation, how the narrative is structured, just how the narrative is structured, period, and the way that John does storytelling. So that was a big thing, and that led me to Southern Seminary, because at that time, Dr. Culpepper was teaching at Southern in Louisville. The guy who ended up advising me there was Jerry Borchert, who right at that time was writing his two-volume commentary on John. Jerry Borchert and Alan really got me focused on John, and I've been there ever since.
Well, that's pretty good. So your basic framework is narratology, but before that, you were like historical, so... What do you want to talk about today in terms of the gospel? You mentioned something at the end of the book. What is it that we're going to have our conversation on today with you?
Broadly speaking, I guess I'd say I started out being interested in John's narrative, which obviously is very deeply tied into its theology. But then also, as you guys I'm sure have talked about, very tied into the history of the book, like how it came to be and where it came to be, how it was responding to its own immediate context. And so down the road, I got involved in and very interested in, I guess, what's more broadly called media criticism, but with a very specific emphasis on studies of collective memory, like how the author of the Gospel of John and the people around that person thought about Jesus, remembered him as a figure from the past. And so that has led me, that plus the literary narrative stuff, has led me to always be real interested in places in the Gospel of John and the way that, I guess, places, times that would carry significant meaning to the author and the original audiences and also to characters in the story. how those characters would interact with those places and times and settings as a way of thinking about how the story's put together, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Let's talk about a specific passage in John and how literary criticism, but specifically media criticism, how we can learn some things from that, especially if we're teaching a Bible study or preparing a sermon.
Right. You want me to just pick a section?
Sure.
Go for it.
Yeah.
John 21 is a great place to go.
Yeah, John, if you want.
So I'm talking specifically there about, if you all, I know you guys remember, if your audience remembers, at the very end of the Gospel of John, there's a unique resurrection story that is set in Galilee, actually, which is also kind of unique in the Gospels, where Jesus goes back up there and meets the disciples while they're fishing on the lake. And they see him on the shore and come to shore and have a meal with him, basically. It's like a cookout with him on the shore. Very, very unique story, but it's very carefully tied to earlier themes in the book. I'd say right now, if you're talking about like my favorite part, just to personally reflect on and teach, that would be the one that comes back to me the most, man, how that happens.
Great.
And I guess the reason for that, or you want to ask, you go ahead, bro. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just affirming but let me do a segue here. One of the challenges with, it seems like to me, with preaching and teaching the narratives of the Gospels is that many of us are introduced to a historical approach, and so we think about, you know, how these events sort of were played out in real life, but there's a huge literary component here. What is the thing that you think pastors or Bible study leaders miss if they miss the literary features in this particular passage?
One of the particularly interesting things about this one, John 21, is the way that the historical aspects of the places play into the way the literary part works too. The obvious literary echoes in this one are the fact that, and this was often pointed out, and you guys may have pointed out in earlier sessions, this episode is really carefully structured to resemble earlier episodes, not just in the book, but in the whole larger early Christian Jesus story. So back in Luke, there's a very explicit story about calling the disciples that involves Peter that happens at the same lake when they're also out on a boat fishing, not even very far across from where they're standing. So in one sense, in the broader tradition, this story of these guys fishing and them seeing Jesus and him talking to them and this encounter with him and being called to some form of discipleship goes back to the very first time they ever really met with him and their initial call to discipleship, which is a pretty cool echo there. But then narrowly in the Gospel of John itself, there is a reference here to when they get to shore, it says Jesus is cooking a fish for them to eat around a charcoal fire. And that word for the charcoal fire is only used a couple times in the New Testament. One time is here where they have this meal with Jesus. The other time is when Peter is betraying Jesus earlier, and it says he was standing outside while Jesus was on trial, warming his hands around the charcoal fire with the servants. So there's kind of an immediate echo in that place, this place beside the lake that takes you back to this other place where Peter had first betrayed him. And of course, famously, Peter betrayed him three times. And so as Jesus is talking to Peter after they have this meal, he talks to him three times very specifically about his love for him, or asks him three times whether he loves him, and they explore what that means. So I guess I'd say, Doug, that it has a lot of literary echoes back to earlier episodes in the story that would bring a lot of that meaning forward. And then just in the place itself, the fire, the shore of the lake, those are established as places elsewhere that have already, those are already meaningful places for people to encounter Jesus and
so what
be
you're,
called to him. So,
what you're
so
saying is
great
there's,
for that.
There's a lot of significance in the details that we might miss if we look at it strictly as a historical story. It's like, oh yeah, it happened there. That's what was going on. But the details say, oh, you need to remember I'm pointing you to something and you need to pull that forward, which I think that's one thing that can be missed is the details are important, especially in a literary sense, rather than just saying, these are the facts, just the facts, dun, 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 dun. The good old Dragnet theme, you know, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
And one thing that Tom points out very well is that the specific use of the Greek for charcoal fire there creates that visual image in your mind. So instead of just, you know, a general reference to a fire, you can visualize the charcoal. You can kind of, you know, it's a very tangible thing. It's the smell of it, the visual of it, the seeing of it, you know, hearing it crackle.
And it's not driftwood where you got logs sticking out, you got to worry about. It's a very self-contained fire. So images are important in telling stories.
So, Tom, let me follow up with a slightly different question here.
Yeah.
So one of the commonalities of many of the people that we've had a chance to converse with in the podcast is the literary focus. But you have a unique secondary focus or auxiliary focus, which is collective memory. So most of our listeners are familiar with the literary approach. Can you explain in just a couple of, you know, a couple of sentences what collective memory teaches us about the Gospels?
Well, broadly speaking, collective memory is the sociological version of memory studies. Like the psychological version is, I remember when I was a kid, I went to school and this thing happened. But the sociological version is how a group of people together think about and talk about the past. And in a religious context, an example would be things we celebrate in churches together, like the Lord's Supper or baptism, where the act of baptism is reminding us of the death and resurrection of Jesus and how we also experience that. You may not explicitly say, well, we're going to reenact the death and resurrection of Jesus, but we know back to Romans 6 and elsewhere that's what that's doing. Same way that the Lord's Supper is always a way of remembering Jesus' death and everything he did for us by thinking about together, hey, we're going to reenact what he did at that time. More broadly, that is looking at how memories get attached to certain places or certain times, so that whenever you refer to the 4th of July or New Year's Day or New Year's Eve, there's just certain memories that come not just to me as a person, but to our entire society together as we think about who we are as people. John uses those better than any, honestly, in my opinion, guys, better than any of the Gospels, and more explicitly. This is why we have all talked about this before in different contexts. He's continually got Jesus going to the temple in these different festivals that carry, like, dedication or tabernacles that have really high symbolic value for Jewish people because they're recalling some story about the past that's tied to their heritage, and then he'll associate himself with that. Or it just shows you that the early Christians were, when they remembered him, it wasn't like remembering your phone number or your, you know, your user access code to something. It was remembering him in light of this other thing. And a lot of times those are tied to places because places are very significant to us. So, like, again, here in this story, like you said, man, the setting of being around a fire is significant here because that's how they thought about him being the place where he was betrayed. The setting of being by the seashore is a place of calling for them, and also earlier.
I just throw something in that one of the significance when you're in a certain place and a significant event happens, then your brain produces adrenaline, and adrenaline is a key factor for remembering. And so it's like a shock system on that. So the fact that this happened by the lake, we remember it because it was important to us. And then we include that detail in future stories, even though nobody else is getting quite the significance that the original teller picked up on that.
So that kind of works then, I guess, as it does with the narrative aspect, because when you insert these locations, even when he's not pointing to them explicitly, and that's what it's really easy to bring this out in your preaching. A casual reader of this story may not necessarily remember that when Jesus and Peter are walking by the lake and talking, it's right across from where he first called Peter to be his disciple the first time. And obviously in this story, whatever was implied by that original invitation to follow Jesus, Peter has destroyed by something very specific that he's done. So it's kind of one of these instances where a lot of times in our lives, you know, you have to go back to the point of origin when you're going to make a fresh start. You just have to go back there again to start over. And actually, it's kind of cool that that's what Jesus does with Peter in this story. He takes him back to the place where it started, back to the place where he betrayed him, and then they go forward from there in a really powerful way. What I actually like about this story, to be honest with you guys, is uniquely, this is all through the Bible, but it's really cool how it plays out here, is how it speaks to this longing that we all have for a second chance and the power of places in that longing, that we have done things in places where we really regret what we did. And this is a cool instance where a person who did a very, very terrible thing that should have put him out is allowed to go back to the place where it started and kind of start over in a really neat way, which we all need. It's an opportunity. Yeah.
And I think one of the points that you're bringing out that I hear is that in the conversation and in the events of chapter 21, the focus is on community remembering itself and community looking forward rather than community looking backwards. It's taking things that happened in the past, and we all know in churches and communities of faith, we have people with exceedingly long memories, and those are like dog chains that are tethered to a huge cement block. That dog's not going anywhere as long as they're tethered to that block. And if you're going to go for a walk and go enjoy the animal, you're going to have to release it from that item that keeps it tethered and start looking forward. And this is the best part, because they are looking forward in John. They're looking forward to new community, I think. So I think that's one of those key points that so often when we're teaching or preaching, we want to deal with the facts or bring things out. And there's a much deeper message here that often gets missed. What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, John definitely ends on an optimistic note. He is looking to the future, I believe. And sometimes we miss that in our reading because we tend to want to read the gospel flat if we're just sort of skimming it for devotionals or, you know, that sort of thing. Now, Tom, let me go back to you and just ask this question. Well, looking at the first half of the end of John 21, it's not the most commonly preached on passage. What do you think is the number one thing that a pastor might miss if they try to tackle this passage?
I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Obviously, it's going to impact what you miss, but or what you see. It's easy to miss, like we've said, like that this is not coming out of the blue. It's actually bringing all the disciples, but Peter very specifically, back to certain places that he knows are places where he was called and where he forsook his calling. And so there's no way he doesn't understand this person, character, appearance, no way he doesn't understand what's going to be coming. When Jesus, the dead Jesus, by the way, says, "Hey man, let's you and me alone go up the lake here. There's going to be some kind of conversation about what has gone down before that." And it's kind of easy to miss that, I think, if you're not thinking on that.
For sure. And let me just follow up and ask it this way, and don't feel the need to agree or disagree. But one of my suspicions would be that there's a temptation to maybe approach this passage as merely a miracle story with the emphasis on the large catch of fish. But if we do that, we miss some things, it seems like to me.
Yes. Because again, even the catch of fish, if you go back to that earlier first encounter that these guys, well, in the very first in John, they've encountered him before they ever have that. When they were first called to discipleship, it was about a story about them catching fish. And they are fishermen. And, you know, that's when he called them to be fishers of men. This time he kind of shifts the metaphor to you're going to be a shepherd, but it's the same thing. You know, this guy's being sent out or sort of recommissioned to do that. And so that's a very powerful thing, especially so if you're speaking to the majority of people in our society. Maybe you guys are exceptions. I'm not the exception, and I've never met anybody who is, except maybe you two, if you are, have things in their past that they seriously regret. A lot of people if they really thought about it, their number one prayer and wish would be God give them a time machine to go backwards and make up for all the stuff that they did in the past that they messed up. And the message of this story is that God's not going to take you back in the past to fix what you did wrong. He's going to take you into the future to fix what you did wrong. And that's his gift. And that we can basically forget all that stuff and move on if we're willing to do so. I think, too, I know you got a cool thing about this particular story. You would love him to just tell Peter, and maybe people miss this too, man, hey, listen, this is all cool, and we're just going to forget this, and I'm gracious, and I'll forgive you. But he really doesn't say that either. It includes a very explicit reference to Peter's death by martyrdom of some kind. It's not a good way to die, however this is described. So it's not like you don't have to live with the consequences of this. It's just we're going to go on. It doesn't render you unable to fulfill what I originally call you to do.
And I think the other part of that is, if we are willing to move on with God, then that future may be something that we wouldn't choose willingly, but he's going to prepare for us. Because Peter could have just fished, and he may have gotten involved in another revolt and just been slaughtered on the field and not accomplished a lot. But walking and following and loving and shepherding and doing those things that God is calling people to do sometimes takes them places that they really didn't think they would ever get and may not actually want to get there if they knew ahead of time that's what's happening. But it's better, you know, better than being separated and just living in the past, I think. So as we look at wrapping this conversation up, there's been a lot of things that we've talked about in terms of this particular passage. What we haven't talked about is the comparisons to the beloved disciple and even the other disciples who are named. Do you have any thoughts in terms of, not that big comparison, because that would take us like 20 minutes to talk about, but the idea of community in the reconciliation process? Because the other disciples see Jesus walking away with Peter and they're going, what's going on? Any thoughts on the community aspect of this particular miracle?
Man, that's a great observation. Douglas, do you have anything for us?
Let me just answer it in a general way. I think that the advantage that scholarship brings to this conversation is it makes the story meaningful on both the individual level and the community level, that it has implications for both. Tom's explanation was deeply rich and allows us to get a much deeper sense of what God is doing here, rather than just the cultural reading lens that we would normally apply, which, as we know in the West, is an individualistic lens. And so being able to recognize both the individualism and the community aspects here and how collective memory informs the way that we should live, I think, like I said, it just adds a richness to our reading of the gospel and helps us to be better followers of Jesus.
Yeah. And further to that, this is actually an awesome question, because as soon as you said that, my mind was like, wow, there's so many ways that apply, the community part applies. One of the things this ties into with the memory thing is, because of the Good Shepherd sayings in the Gospel of John, at least the people in the Johannine circle of the early church remember Jesus as the shepherd, using these many, many metaphorical references to God as
John
a shepherd throughout
passage.
The Old Testament.
Yeah.
And so in this passage, though, to your comment, man, the first thing I thought when you asked that, Sam, was there's a certain accountability element to this, because with Peter, this is happening in front of at least one other person and an applied other group of people. But when you actually look at what happens in the three times if you go back and read it, the three times Jesus and Peter are talking, he keeps asking him, do you love me? And Peter's like, of course I love you. What Jesus never says to him is what he most wanted to hear, which was, I forgive you. He tells him each time, feed my sheep. So the reason that I'm going through this, me, Jesus, going through this with you, is not to just restore you so that you feel better and now you don't feel so bad that you betrayed me. It is so that you can get back to doing for my people what I originally called you to do, which was to feed them. So it is actually a great instance, man, of a case where what he's calling you to do through your restoration and healing is to serve and heal other people, never yourself. There's no instance in this where he's like, okay, man, well, I forgive you. Now you can go back and go fishing. That's not how it works. I'm going to forgive you so that you can go back and do what I was originally calling you to do, which obviously for him, but for all of us too, is to serve other people, to feed Christ's sheep. So it kind of redirects it back to the community and our responsibility to the community and to each other that way.
That's pretty good. Pretty powerful. So, well, this has been a great conversation. So thank you for taking some time this morning out of your busy schedule for the conversation.
Thank those
who are listening to this and hope that they find something worthwhile. Any final thoughts, Douglas?
Nope.
Nothing further to say. Any final thoughts, accolades you want to talk about? What a wonderful scholar Douglas is.
Flattery won't get you too far, so it's
Douglas is a great example of a person who has done very serious scholarship, who has served the academic community while also serving the church. So if you have this idea that there's these scholars out there and then preachers, this guy proves that that ain't how that works. So I'm thankful to you for that, man, seriously.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, that concludes our first year's recordings of Conversations in the Gospel of John. Please contact us at cgj@stanharshine.com with any comments. We look forward to hearing from you. Bye now.